WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
If it's Monday night, it's got to be Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. So thanks for having me on.
Kevin, good for you to hold back and let him tell his story.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
You guys are the center of the universe today, at least the political universe.
I believe both of you are from the area. Marshfield guys, yes, no?
Correct, yeah.
That's right.
There's only one person not from Marshfield in this room right now. And it's you.
It's me. I'm the outcast.
Well, you've always been generous with the time. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I'm honored to be on your show tonight, Kevin, with that impressive lineup you have.
I believe our guest that we've been waiting for, Congressman Stephen Lynch.
Kevin, good to join you.
The governor of the Commonwealth, Charlie Baker. You ready?
I got to tell you that it was really nice to hear Aerosmith on the intro there.
You're going
to
be the rock and roll governor?
I don't know about that, but...
We have Mayor Joe Sullivan joining us. Sir, how are you?
Well, Kevin, very good to be with you again.
Dr. Drew Pinsky. Dr. Drew, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ming Tsai, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Massachusetts State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Hello, Auditor. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
Your dial is indeed set to 95.9 WATD, and you are tuned into Monday Night Talk, as we begin yet another year on the radio dial, 2018. This is, of course, the first program, and it'll be kind of a mix bag, so to speak. We will, of course, give you some fresh material and also delve back into a couple of great segments that we did in 2017. Our first segment up just after we check in for traffic is Bob Parkus. Remember Bob Parkus? WATD's Bob Parkus. You hear Bob in several different capacities, whether it's spots that he has voiced, whether it's he's doing the good, the bad, and the really, really stupid, which is the segment that follows the 7:30 news during the weekdays here. I think he does story time. You hear him sometimes chiming in on the Mark Green show on Sundays. Bob's everywhere. And if you're a Marshfield resident, well, then you have a chance to see Bob from time to time when whether it's the annual town meeting or special town meeting or just Bob pedaling around on his bicycle. Bob is everywhere. Bob has quite the opinion, and Bob wanted to pop in. I was actually going to use a segment that he and I did earlier this year. Bob stopped me, and he goes, no, let me come in, and I want to do something. It'll be fresh, and it'll be something if you want to kind of replay it throughout the year. You could do that. I says, okay. So we're going to talk with Bob, kind of get his take on a couple of different issues. With, of course, our elected leaders up at the State House. And, of course, he wants to take task about a very special project that's going to involve $10 million of our tax dollars. So we'll talk with Bob Parkus about that coming up at 6:20 or a little after 6:20. Then, of course, we dig into the archives. The next couple of segments following the Bob Parkus segment, one, of course, with Congressman Stephen Lynch, talking a little bit about the whole net neutrality vote that the FCC took. Don't know how many people had a chance to hear that segment, but I thought it's somewhat valuable to see what, you know, our elected leaders are going to do in regards to net neutrality and what the broadband providers are going to do to rectify this. Also, we have Governor Charlie Baker. He joined us a couple of weeks ago. We'll chat with him. Then for our number two, we dig deeper into the Monday Night Talk archives. First, of course, we did a great program at the Kingston Council on Aging in July. And, of course, one of the folks who was part of that show was Marshfield's own Casey Sherman, author, producer. Of course, we chatted with him in regards to the Ice Bucket Challenge, the Pete Frates book. You'll get to hear that as well. Mr. Dean Koontz, best-selling author as well, and we'll chat with him for a little bit. So that's all coming up right here on Monday Night Talk, your first Monday Night Talk program of 2018.
Hey, it's Jeffrey from Brennan Smoke Shop. I want to wish all of our very good customers and friends a happy, healthy, and safe New Year. I'd also like to thank you from the bottom of my heart for your continued patronage of our small business here on the South Shore. Without the support from this most excellent community of people, our small business couldn't survive this highly regulated, highly taxed industry. From all of us at Brennan Smoke Shop, thank you. In return for your patronage, it is our commitment to you to stand up and fight for your rights, freedoms, and liberties. This year and every year, infinity plus infinity plus infinity plus infinity. Brennan Smoke Shop, Plymouth, Pembroke, Brockton, Wareham, Raynham, Taunton, Stoughton, and now on Pope's Island in New Bedford. Brennan Smoke Shop, the very best smoke shop in Massachusetts. Customers must have a valid state or federal ID to enter the store.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
All right, welcome back to Monday Night Talk. And I have to tell you, you have to always try to start off something on the right foot. I am attempting to start off the new year, 2018, on the right step, on the right show. I'm trying to at least go in the right direction.
You're shooting yourself in the left foot is what you're doing right now.
Am I really?
Yeah.
I actually favor my right foot.
You're looking for a positive comment right now.
No.
No.
But the voice that you are hearing is...
mine.
It's yours. It's Mr. Bob Parkus.
Mr. I like that.
Mr. Bob Parkus.
Right, and I'm here to talk about...
We don't know because see you.
I wouldn't tell you
what you did is you tempted me with unknown bait to do a segment, and I was like, I was intrigued because you and I you've done segments on the radio program prior, and I love the content, I love the discussion, I love the points you bring up. I don't have to agree with your points.
Oh, you have to, yeah.
I don't have to.
You want me to come back?
But the idea. What I'm saying here is that. This microphone, this megaphone that Ed Perry loves to pass around that has been around for 40 years, it's the idea of letting folks come in and share their thoughts and whims on certain items.
How about elected representatives? Our elected representatives.
Really?
Here in the state of Massachusetts.
Really?
Because okay? I got a couple of things I'd like to say.
You know what? Get it off your chest.
I want to unburden myself.
Oh, my goodness.
Believe it or not, your elected representative up there in Boston, sitting there under the Golden Dome, votes the way he is told to vote by the leadership 96% of the time. You think I'm making that up. It's an actual fact. 96% of the time, where I'm from, Marshfield, my state rep, Jim Cantwell, exceeds. He actually votes 99.44% of the time. The way he is told to vote, the man is 99.44%.
Did you just call him a bar of Ivory soap?
I did. He's pure.
Okay.
No one's 100% pure.
I think that
99.44%.
Being a gentleman who delves in sales and commercials, and I'm sure you remember the Ivory soap commercial.
So I do. It floats.
So it does float.
It floats.
I tried that. It was a science experiment.
It does float.
So
they put air in it.
So what is your point in regards
Here's my point. Global warming. Now, whether or not you believe that the Earth is warming up or not, today the temperature is hovering around zero or so. The fact is that we have had ocean storms for all recorded and unrecorded history, and our seacoast is changing.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily washing away, but changing. So what to do? And what has this got to do with politicians? Well, here's what it is. This is the most recent outrage. Your state reps want to spend $10 million on a short section of shoreline in Scituate called Hummerock Beach. And what they want to do is to take $10 million and squirt a lot of sand from the nearby ocean floor up onto Hummerock. $10 million, your money. This is state dough. You're paying for this, all right? Now, think for a moment. What do you suppose would happen to all that sand? Well, none of us can predict the future, but if the past is any indication, let me tell you a story. this really happened. You want to hear this story?
I love stories.
Oh, okay, here we go. Once upon a time, about a dozen or so years ago, the state of Massachusetts paid $800,000 to have PA Landers bring sand and gravel from somewhere inshore here and to bring it across the Julian Street Bridge that goes from Marshfield to Humorock and then dump $800,000 worth of sand and gravel on Humorock Beach. Now, in doing this, through no fault of P.A. Landers, the Julian Street Bridge suffered tremendous vibrations and had to be rebuilt for about $2.5 million. That's good, because that provided all sorts of employment opportunities. And in addition, you got to watch that sand on Humorock Beach, $800,000 worth. It might just as well have been greenback dollars, to be honest with you. And you got to say, gee, I wonder how long that will last. Well, my guess was 4 months. I was wrong. It was gone in three. $800,000 washed out to sea on its way to Sandwich, by the way. If you look at the map, you can see where the sand goes in the big swirl, okay? It comes back again in a 1,000 to 2,000 years, but you can see where it's going. $800,000 greenback dollars washing their way to Sandwich. Fabulous. Now, someone pointed out a few years later that this was a tremendous waste of money. And the answer came down from your elected politicians, we didn't put enough sand there. So now they have done a study for $300,000 to see what should be done about Humorock, because Humorock is a barrier beach. Mm-hmm. When Humorock gets blasted away and the sands are shifted aside, Marshfield will then be hit by the direct action of the North Atlantic storm. So this is a serious subject. They spent $300,000. What should we do about Humorock? Well, if they're going to spend $300,000, are they then going to say, well, you know what? That's a barrier beach. It's going to shift this way and that way because that's the natural progression of things. The fact that folks were silly enough to build homes on it should not cause us to do something equally as foolish. So therefore, we will do nothing. And if you want to live out there on a shifting sand dune, best of luck. Please, if you get into trouble in the middle of a storm, don't call us and ask for help. Please don't do that. You should know better. You're a Homo sapiens. You have the power of reason. So just don't call us. Try to sell it if you can. Or if you want to go down with your house, go down with your house. You have that right. All right? Instead, what did they do? $10 million. My money. They're going to bring big dredges down there, your money too, and they are going to suck up the sand from just offshore. From just offshore, they're going to dig a hole, and then they're going to dump that sand on Humorock. You would think.
I have questions.
I got to finish this. Right. Then you can question, right. Okay? Right. You would think that the homeowners would say, wow, sigh of relief, we're saved. Wrong. Here's what the homeowners say instead. That's my beach. That's a private beach, and I don't want people coming down here and walking on my private beach. Mm. Families come down all afternoon, they bring their children, and they enjoy my private beach. Hmm. That was the reaction.
Okay.
Are you kidding? Are you kidding? What is wrong? All right, now you got questions?
I do have questions.
I hope you would.
All right, so here's I'll throw out a couple of different things. You think about, you mentioned P.A. Landers. I know for a fact, well, first off, there was a time that they had three pits. I think they no longer have the Plymouth pit because they sold that except for the concrete division to T.L. Edwards. But that was one of their main pits. I know they got a pit in Hanover, and they might still have one.
Yeah, well, the glacier made P.A. Landers possible.
Of course they did. But what's interesting is you're talking about shifting sand. Well, technically what they do, what P.A. Landers
does, replacing
they it. They have satellite pits where somebody pays them because they want to clear out all of what Mother Nature did, and basically they want to level that area, whether they got to get rid of trees, stumps, or sand. I mean, you look at Southers Marsh. P.A. Landers was down in Southers Marsh for a number of years in the early 2000s, Before that, I want to say right around 1999, 2000, where they were taking sand and they were selling the sand all over the place.
Well, I got no beef with landers.
No, but I'm just saying, you talk about shifting sands. It's funny you mentioned that, where the sand is going to shift from somewhere, whether it's Plymouth or Hanover, and it's going to get shifted to Marshfield just to get reshifted down to Sandwich.
So, yeah, it's okay with me that it goes to Sandwich because that doesn't cost me anything. Mm. It's $800,000.
Sure.
You know, and Landers says, fine, you want us to do that?
They don't mind. They don't mind. But then the other thing that I wanted to throw out, I have family that lives on Hummer Rock, that lives on Central Avenue, that has had homes, and I grew up down on Hummer Rock. You didn't know that.
I did not.
But I take
back everything I said.
No. I'm not asking you to. And again, that voice is Mr. WATD's Bob Parkus, who you hear on here from time to time, not only on Monday Night Talk, but on our radio program. But I want to throw out is, I thought we had, didn't we have a major hurricane that put all kinds of stones up on the beach? And when it was thought that they wanted to bring sand in or they wanted to remove the stones, there was this big hullabaloo about removing. Mother Nature put those stones there. Because anybody who walks along the beach at Hummer Rock, it's stones. It's there's tons
of stones.
Did you
mention Mother Nature?
I did.
Let us talk about Mother Nature.
Please do.
Because in 1898, they had what is known as the Portland Gale.
Mm-hmm.
Named after a big steamship, a paddle wheeler that went down and took everyone with it. And during that 1898 storm, a northeaster, the North and South River changed the mouth. And it used to go out into the Atlantic at what is now Rexham Beach, mm-hmm. and that closed off and opened up a new mouth at what we now call the mouth of the North River right there at the tip of Hummer Rock.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the kind of force that we are going to stop with $800,000 worth of sand, $10 million worth of sand. Are you kidding? How about $110 million worth of sand? It's still going down a Sandwich.
But so my question is that, am I wrong in assumption? I don't know what you know, if you know about the history. And I've got what hurricane it was, whether it was Gloria or one of those storms in the past 35 years that put all those rocks and stones, and there was a big discussion about not removing them because Mother Nature put them there. Then the fact is then why would you want to be putting, squirting sand up from the ocean floor up there? Isn't that kind of heresy that you're doing that? And the secondary question is, who's doing the dredging? Because it's very interesting that here in Plymouth County, I don't know if Scituate is technically in Plymouth County or if they're in Norfolk County or if they're in a neighboring county here, but money was spent, and we've had discussions here on this radio station about the county purchasing a dredging machine only to wonder what the hell are they doing with it, if anything has even been done with it.
Well, let me tell you, please keep the dredging machine away from the North and South River, and I will tell you why.
Okay.
As we sit here, high and dry, they have plans to dredge out behind Hummer Rock, dig a big hole, because the marinas want Hummer Rock to be deep. They want the mouth of the North River to be deep so that they can have large, expensive yachts that can have easy access in and out of the Atlantic.
Mm.
And so taxpayers then spend a lot of money that benefits recreational boaters for the most part, and the marinas even more than that. And let me ask you, if you dig a big hole behind a pile of sand, what happens to the pile of sand? That's a real question.
The sand that's pulled out, or what happens to the sand where it
What happens? To... Okay, I dug the hole. What's going to happen with the hole?
It's going to cave in.
That's correct.
Yes.
And the Hummer Rock is going to cave in on the backside into the hole that they dredge, while at the same time they're sucking up sand on the ocean side to put on Hummer Rock. It's like a child playing on the seashore with a bucket and a hose. It's utterly ridiculous. Who gains from all this?
So I would ask you then, what would be a better alternative? Is there an alternative? Is it better to do nothing? Is it better to find another alternative that isn't just going to simply wash away?
You know what the federal government is doing? I can tell you. Because you know that out on the tip of Hummer Rock, that land is owned by the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
It's an Air Force retirement vacation spot, okay? Well, here's what they're doing. It's washing away. I've taken pictures of the parking lot, which is now sitting on the beach. They had two condominiums that were up on the hill, which they actually took down, dismantled, and removed because of the bad publicity that was going to come when those two condominiums caved over and fell down into the Atlantic Ocean. Yeah. This is all true. The federal government is saying, okay, we built on a sand dune. The ocean is wrecking the sand dune. That's what sand dunes do.
Mm-hmm.
And they're leaving it alone. That's what the federal government is doing. They're leaving it alone. They are not putting up revetments. They're not doing dredging. They're not replenishing. They're doing zero. It's the state of Massachusetts, your state tax money, that is going to be blown away, literally blown and washed away with this sand project to temporarily beef up the beach at Humorock.
Has this money already been appropriated?
Yes.
Okay, so it's already in the pipeline.
Oh, yeah, it's going to have it. Pipeline, good way. good way to describe it, yeah.
What's the next course of action?
The next course of action is that the people are now complaining because there are two things they're complaining about. Number one, it's going to have to be a public beach. They don't like that because they paid all this money, okay? Mm. And the second thing is they're not sure about the engineering plan. It looks a little bit as though they're going to raise a road out there, and how are people on this high road going to get down to their home, and will this high road then trap water and cause greater damage to their houses? So that's what people are wondering about, and with good reason. The fact is that Humorock is a barrier beach. If you want to build a house on a barrier beach, be my guest. But please don't ask me to care about what happens to you.
One last question I'll ask you before we wrap up this fantastic start to 2018 with the one and only Bob Parkes.
I am the one and only.
It is an election year for many state officials. We know whether it's state senate, whether it's state representative, the governor's up, you know, the constitutional offices are up. We do have congressmen and congresswomen who are up. Give me your thoughts. I mean, is this food for thought for folks when they're deciding what they're going to do come September, November?
Why does Representative Cantwell vote the way he's told to vote 99 and 44, 100% of the time? And by the way, he's open for improvement. I think he can do better this year. So it doesn't matter who's in there. They all vote the way they're told to vote. Who really runs the state of Massachusetts?
But so I'll throw the question back at you because we still have 2 minutes here. Is why aren't these things, like we look back last January, we look back a year, and it was around towards the end of the month when our elected officials voted themselves pay raises. Remember that?
Well, they're doing a good job.
But what I'm saying, though, is they voted pay raises. They were voted pay raises.
But no sales tax.
Stipends. Right. Stipends that they got for serving on committees, whether they headed up the committees or whether they were vice chairs. They got a little bit of a bump.
Well, they get rewarded for voting
the right
way.
What I'm saying, though, is are these things that people are going to remember, or are they going to, if they're not mad already by that, if this isn't something that upsets them, what will upset them to want to make change?
Well, did they remember last year and the year before that and the year before that and the year before that?
Nope.
You just vote for the person who's most famous, that's all.
So it's a popularity contest.
That's all it is.
That's what we have figured out here. Bob, I want to thank you. Anything you want to say just to kind of wrap this fantastic segment up?
Well, I can't wait to bring my children down to the beach.
Well, hopefully there'll be a beach to talk about.
Well, I got
to
hurry on that one.
You got to hurry on it. There he is, the one
there
and
he
only.
Goes.
He's leaving the building, just like Elvis did. Leaves the building. Mr. Bob Parkes was our guest for this very first segment of 2018, and it was fantastic to have him on here to represent now, as promised in the opening. We do have, I kind of wanted to pluck from a couple of different guests that we've had over 2017. It's oddly enough, I know last week we kind of did a best of and remembered some of our colleagues and some of the folks who left us, and also kind of commemorated 40 years, and we did that with Ed Perry. Well, stay tuned as we have more Monday Night Talk. Of course, before the 7 o'clock hour, you will hear from Congressman Stephen Lynch. I thought it'd be great to have him back on. He was on just a couple of weeks ago talking about net neutrality. We have him, and also when we spoke with Governor Charlie Baker a week prior to that. So you'll be hearing that coming up in just a few moments. You are listening to Monday Night Talk right here on 95.9 WAED. Stay tuned.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
McGuigan's Pub in downtown Whitman is a great place to unwind any night of the week. Stop in for Singo on Monday night. There's the always popular Irish Sessions every Tuesday night, half-price pizza every Wednesday night, and Friday and Saturday nights feature the best in live entertainment. Catch your favorite game on McGuigan's 8 big flat screens and enjoy a pint at their beautiful 54-foot mahogany bar. Whether you're a regular or coming in for the first time, you're always a friend of McGuigan's Pub, 546 Washington Street, Whitman Center.
Download the Monday Night Talk podcast from iTunes for free. Just search for Monday Night Talk, WATD. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk. Download the Monday Night Talk podcast from iTunes for free. Just search for Monday Night Talk, WATD. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
And joining us here another segment of Monday Night Talk, we are joined by your congressman, Stephen Lynch, serving. It's the 8th Congressional District, 8th Massachusetts Congressional?
That's correct.
You know, Congressman, I follow what you do. I want to say Mickey does a great job. Please tell her I said hi.
Thank you.
One of the things that I have been following, and I think a lot of folks here in Massachusetts and across the country are following, is the most recent vote regarding the FCC and net neutrality.
All right.
That's why I reached out to your office to get you on the show tonight and get right to the nuts and bolts of it. Give me your thoughts on this situation as it stands right now.
Well, to be honest, first of all, great to be with you again, Kevin. And but a lot of people don't realize. So we also have this big tax bill that's before us, and we're fighting about that. And that's getting a lot of news. But personally, in my district, I got more calls on the net neutrality issue than I did on the tax reform piece. By far, it wasn't even close. So maybe people just understand the net neutrality issue. It's maybe a little more clear to people than the tax issue, which is more complicated. But also, I think people know what's at stake. And I was just down with the we had a protest outside the FEC a few nights ago the night before the vote. And we had a good turnout there, a lot of people from our district as well as across the country. So the problem that we're facing here is that a lot of people don't really understand the long-term effects that this might have.
Right.
So with the existing rules prior to the change, you know, all internet traffic, basically there was a requirement that these internet service providers treat everybody the same. Don't give priorities to one message or to one site, but to treat all traffic equally. Don't give preferential treatment to the big guys, but give everyone fair treatment. That is changed now. So what we're concerned about is that the broadband carriers and also the internet service providers will now be able to give fast lane access to people and big operations that pay for it, and also in some cases, and this has happened in the past, they can actually conduct throttling, which is a term that they use for slowing down someone else's internet access or broadband speed. So instead of everyone being treated equally, number one, they can require, say, Netflix to pay more for high speed access, and in turn, then Netflix would have to charge the consumer more for that. So it drives up the prices. And also, if they make it more difficult for some of these early startups to get access to consumers, and we've seen some tremendous innovation, think about Uber and others, then they could actually squelch the development of new apps and new products and new services offered through the internet by simply slowing down that access and really stifling innovation. So it's just, you know, we have seen so much innovation and so much progress. I mean, think about the internet and how explosive innovation is and change has been. Now the big people want to come in and, you know, Comcast and others, Verizon, and they want to have control over that, control over the access, but also ultimately control over content as well, which is extremely alarming.
What can be done in Congress? My understanding is that Congress can do some a congressional review vote, or something can be done in regards to at least head this off or at least start the process. Is that true?
It is. Right now, well, once this is actually fully implemented and there's a published rule on it, Mike Doyle, who's a colleague of mine from Pittsburgh, he's one of our ranking members on the Commerce Committee. He has a bill that would basically repeal the FCC's actions in eliminating or repealing net neutrality. So he's going to file that in the House. There's a companion bill over in the Senate. I think Chuck Schumer and Ed Markey and some others are doing a companion piece over in the Senate. And we will try to repeal the FCC's reversal of net neutrality.
Is there any chance that there could be some kind of a bipartisan movement, or could this die on the president's desk if in fact you're able to get bipartisan movement?
Well, I think there are some sort of libertarian Republicans. Rand Paul comes to mind. Rob Corker. So I think Collins up in Maine. You know, I think there are some people who understand the value of net neutrality. So I think there's the possibility that we could pull enough people over. It's really not a hard and fast red versus blue issue.
Mm-hmm.
It's really about innovation, giving access to consumers. So much of our lives now is connected through the internet, social media, our commerce itself. Look at Amazon.
Yep.
So much of our daily lives are dependent or connected to the internet. I think people get the importance of this. So I think there's the opportunity for us through debate and through persuasion. And I think also the public has a huge voice in this. This is a direct service to them. So I think they would have the ability to, since there's no ideological underpinnings to the opposition to net neutrality, I think there's the opportunity to swing some of the Republicans onto our column, you know?
Well, before we let you go, we thank you again for joining us at this this late hour, asking for you to come on and kind of just share your thoughts on this. And we are speaking with Congressman Stephen Lynch. And I'm sure, I don't know if you're aware or not, I know that the State Attorney General here in Massachusetts, Maura Healey, has filed suit. I don't know if there are other attorney generals around the country who have done the same thing in regards to net neutrality, but could that put teeth into this vote in net neutrality?
Sure. I think the more the merrier. Obviously, Maura Healey's our chief law enforcement officer in Massachusetts, so that would have a significant impact. And I'm sure there are other states that are doing something similar. That's usually how it happens. There's a growing call. So, I think Maura Healey is responding to the public will, and I think there are other Schneiderman down in New York. I think he has also expressed a willingness to go after them as well. So, let's hope we can get more people on the bandwagon.
Well, we thank you very much for joining us here for a few minutes, and big plans for the holidays. What are you doing for Christmas?
Well, hopefully they'll let us come home. We're down here until Christmas Eve. Well, Friday before Christmas. So we still have to, pass a continuing resolution to keep the government running.
Yep.
That vote is coming up. Also, the tax bill is coming up this week. So, yeah, I hope to be back by Saturday or Sunday and enjoy the holidays with family like everyone else.
Congressman, we wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, and we'll look forward to talking to you in 2018, sir.
Merry Christmas to you, Kevin, and to all your listeners. Thank you.
Excellent. There he is, Congressman Stephen Lynch, talking a little bit about net neutrality. I don't know about you, but I'm not a fan of having to pay a Netflix tax or having to pay extra to be able to do a Google search. So, again, this will be something that we will follow and keep an eye on. But for the moment, we are going to step aside. And when we come back, more Monday Night Talk, heard right here on 959 WATD.
Dad, you know I'm willing to drive.
Honey, we're all set here.
But your eyes, you even say so yourself, don't like driving at night.
Well, that's why I'm following the plow.
But that's a sander, Dad. You know what they say.
It pays to stay way back.
It pays to stay way back.
Oh!
Too late.
I'm Peter Brown of Tiny & Sons Auto Glass in Pembroke. It pays to stay way back. However, if your windshield is broken, just call 1-888-64-TINIES. And thank you.
Follow Monday Night Talk on Twitter. Start at 959watd.com/Monday Night Talk. And don't forget to add hashtag Monday Night Talk to your tweets. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk. Be a part of the show. Call and join in on the conversation. 781-837-4900. Now, back to Monday Night Talk.
Hey, welcome back to Monday Night Talk. And our first guest joining us, we are welcoming back the governor of the Commonwealth, Charlie Baker. Governor, welcome back to Monday Night Talk.
How you doing, Kevin?
We're doing pretty good. Before we get started, I want to wish you all a belated happy birthday. I know you were celebrating your birthday last week.
You know, I'm to the point now where I'm happy to have them, but I try not to keep too close an attention to the number.
Absolutely. I definitely understand. Reason why we have you on, a couple of things.
Thank you.
Absolutely. How did you celebrate? Did you celebrate in some quiet way?
Yeah, my wife and I went out to dinner at a restaurant in the neighborhood.
Good thing to do. Definitely a good
thing
to do.
Very lucky.
Well, I know since your administration took office, one of the keen focuses that you guys have looked to tackle is the opioid and heroin epidemic. I know within the last week, the administration released news of a package that also includes legislation called the CARE Act. Now, with the limited time that we have for the segment, could you briefly kind of share some details of the initiative?
Sure, Kevin. What I would start by saying is that, we passed a bill a couple years ago, and there were four key pillars to it: prevention, education, intervention, treatment, and recovery. And this legislation and some of the administrative actions we're going to take going forward build on that. And let's start with the fact that we get the fact that this remains a terrible crisis here in the Commonwealth, but there is some good news. The prevention education initiatives that we pursued previously seem to have bent the trend a little bit. Instead of having a continued climb in opioid prescription writing, overdoses, and deaths, which has been happening every year for the past 15 years in Massachusetts, we actually saw a 30% decline in prescriptions and a 10% drop in deaths for the first 9 months of 17 over the first 9 months of 16. That's the first time that's happened in 15 years. That's the good news. We can also take a certain measure of satisfaction in the fact that literally 97% of the prescriptions that are being written in Massachusetts are being written using the prescription monitoring program we put in place about a year ago. So there's some good news there. We've also added 1,100 treatment beds over the course of the past couple of years, which is another good piece of news. But obviously, there's still far too many people who are dying, far too many people who are dealing with addiction generally. And the other really bad news in this is the presence of fentanyl. If you go back to 2014, fentanyl was present about 15% of the time in the overdose deaths in Massachusetts. In 2017, it's present in about 80% of them. So the arrival of this synthetic fentanyl, which is manufactured in China, and literally in some cases gets mailed into the U.S., in other cases finds its way into the U.S. through Mexico, has really become a very significant and very deadly part of the whole opioid heroin problem in Massachusetts. The new bill basically does a couple of things, which I'll speak to briefly. One is we don't have a very good aftercare system for people after they receive detox services. And part of the reason for that is because we haven't really done a very good job of describing it, credentialing it, certifying it, and then figuring out how to pay for it the way we would with the way we treat people who are dealing with diabetes or congestive heart failure or some other chronic condition. So we need to do that. And this bill would authorize the Commonwealth to put together a lot of the standards and the rules around aftercare and credentialing and all the rest. The second big thing it does is it takes a really hard run at what I would call the whole notion of reporting and making docs and other prescribers who are prescribing way beyond the limits that are established under state law automatically having them referred to their boards of registration, so those boards can actually engage their practitioner community and how to become much more consistent with the rules with respect to prescribing. Because prescribing's down, we still prescribe too much. We need more treatment capacity. We're continuing to build that. But the big thing we really need to do is create an aftercare system for people who come out of detox and that are looking to be supported in the community as they go back to their whatever their daily life is.
What kind of investment is the state going to have to invest into this legislation, and how has the Trump administration been receptive to combating the epidemic?
So we think the total value of the investment we're proposing to make here is somewhere between $140 and $150 million of state and federal money. And obviously, the federal money is going to be coming from Washington, and we are going to see if we can get the Trump administration to help us with a couple of relatively minor waivers here to make it possible for pharmacists to be more involved in dispensing Narcan, which is an overdose reversal drug. Mm-hmm. And we're also going to see if we can get the Fed to help us a little bit with some of the rules around addiction treatment for people who are dealing with addiction. I served, as you know, I think, on the President's Opioid Task Force. We produced a pretty good report. It's got a lot of things in there they can do administratively and a bunch of things they can do with regulation and with statutory change. And my hope is that they chase some of that stuff because it will make a big difference.
Well, we thank you for at least discussing that legislation and the package, the CARE Act, and we'll look forward to more news on that. Probably the other thing, if you could touch upon briefly before we let you go, again, we're speaking with Governor Charlie Baker, is you signed a bipartisan contraceptive coverage legislation today. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, that was the access bill, which has been, which passed the Senate, I think, unanimously, and passed the House, I think, like 135 to 15 or something like that. Pretty bipartisan. Worked through with the health insurance plans and with the provider community, and generally we'll make sure that, you know, sort of irrespective of whatever federal policy we have in Washington, women in Massachusetts will have access to very affordable reproductive services and birth control and family planning services. And, you know, there's a growing body of evidence out there that if we do the right kinds of things with this, if we give women access to the services that they need to help them ensure that they make good decisions on this stuff and they have access to the right kinds of supports, you know, we've seen pretty significant drops in unwanted pregnancy and teen pregnancy, and those are good things.
Those are key things. Two last things I want to kind of throw at you, and that is, I know that you are a musically inclined kind of a guy, and we lost a couple of big names over the past couple of months, most recently Malcolm Young of AC/DC, kind of known as the glue guy of the group, suffering from dementia. He passed away the past 24 to 48 hours. And then Tom Petty, give me your thoughts on that.
You know, Malcolm Young was Angus Young's older brother.
Right.
Malcolm wrote most of the songs, although Angus was definitely the front man. There's no question about that. I saw them for the first time at Boston Garden when I was probably about 20, which at this point was a very long time ago. And I was a huge fan, and I was a huge fan for a very long time. I think they're truly one of the greatest rock bands of all time. I think Back in Black, which is the album they made after their first lead singer, Bon Scott,
passed away,
died of alcohol poisoning. I think that was truly one of the greatest rock albums of all time. I think it's the second best selling rock album of all time behind Thriller. And my mother died of Alzheimer's. I feel terrible for anybody who has to put up with and suffer through one of these terrible memory diseases. And I'm sure for Malcolm and his family and for Angus and for the rest of their family, this whole thing was a really horrible, crummy way for it all to come to an end for him. But boy, what a band and what a legacy.
Yep.
And as far as Tom Petty's concerned, you know, another sort of major force in music throughout my lifetime. And I know he wasn't from Boston. He's from Florida, but a lot of his early material kind of broke on Boston radio. And he had a huge fan base here long before he had a fan base in many other places. And I saw him play here a few times. I saw him play at the Paradise like 12 zillion years ago.
Great club.
And then most recently, like a lot of people, I saw him play at Fenway in 2014.
Year, yeah.
And they just blew the roof off that place, to the extent that Fenway has a roof. but what I would say is that Tom Petty, like Malcolm Young and the guys in AC/DC, they just really knew how to write a hook. I mean, the amount of material that those two bands, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers and AC/DC, put out just year after year after year, you just couldn't wait to fire up first on your turntable and then in your cassette player and then on your CD and then eventually on your iPod and then on your phone was mind-boggling.
Yep.
I mean, what a repertoire and what a library for both of them. But they do say one very important thing to both you and me, Kevin, which is we are not as young as we used to be, and there's just no question about that.
Amen. Amen. Well, listen, our time here is done. I want to wish you and yours a happy Thanksgiving. I hope you have a great holiday, and we look forward to the next time that we talk to you, my friend.
Well, that's great. Thank you very much, Kevin. You take care, and you have a great holiday, too.
You got it. There he is.
Bye-bye.
Charlie Baker joining us here on Monday Night Talk, and we're going to step aside when we come back. State Representative Jim Cantwell will be joining us right here on 95.9 WATD. You're listening to Monday Night Talk.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
The South Shore's breaking news, weather, and traffic station.
95.9 WATD FM Marshfield and 95.9 WATD.com.
McGuigan's Pub in downtown Whitman is a great place to unwind any night of the week. Stop in for Singo on Monday night. There's the always popular Irish Sessions every Tuesday night, half-price pizza every Wednesday night, and Friday and Saturday nights feature the best in live entertainment. Catch your favorite game on McGuigan's 8 big flat screens and enjoy a pint at their beautiful 54-foot mahogany bar. Whether you're a regular or coming in for the first time, you're always a friend of McGuigan's Pub, 546 Washington Street, Whitman Center.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi. This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
All right, we are live here from the Kingston Council on Aging. And again, I want to thank our two guests, Terry and Dina, talking a little bit about hoarding and clearing out your clutter. I was hoping for medicine, personally. I could use it because I'm a prolific hoarder. And I have witnesses, but our next guest is a New York Times bestselling author of 10 books. I could be wrong. We'll check with him in a moment, including The Finest Hours, now a major motion picture starring Casey Affleck and Chris Pine. Don't forget the Boston Strong book based on the new Patriots Day starring Mark Wahlberg. Also, he's a contributing writer for Esquire, Huffington Post, Fox News, Boston Magazine. He's appeared as a guest, as an analyst for more than 100 television news programs. I'm not done yet. Oh, wait, there's more. This individual also is the author of Search for the Strangler, Animal,
Bad Blood, Black Irish, Black Dragon, and the forthcoming Above and Beyond, and the Ice Bucket Challenge. Ladies and gentlemen, Casey Sherman. Welcome back to the program, sir.
Thank you, Kevin. I think I'm done, right? I mean, I think our time is up, right?
No, but it was funny because when you walked up, I go, which clone are you? Because there can't be just one of you because you do so
I
much.
I wish.
It's fantastic to have you here. And knowing that we have you here on the cusp of a big book release, I think we probably, before we do anything, should wish your co-writer
for this.
Dave Wedge, who's celebrating a birthday on...
Turns 25 today.
Yeah, and I'm 26.
Me too.
But I have to say, it's awesome to have you here. So much that in the half-hour segment that we have you, I'm looking forward to at least gleaning from you to find out where things are at this particular point in time.
Well, you know, I mean, I love coming on the show. You guys have been incredibly supportive of my career, of my co-author Dave Wedge's career as well. We've been extremely busy over the past few years, as you can imagine. As you mentioned, Kevin, we've got a very big book that's about to launch September 5th. It's called The Ice Bucket Challenge, mm-hmm. which really chronicles the story behind the story of Pete Frates, the young man who was at 27 years old, was stricken with ALS, given a death sentence, and literally used that death sentence to change the world.
Mm.
Now, I write hero stories. That's what I do. I wrote The Finest Hours, which is about four young, brave men who tackle 60 to 80-foot seas with a simple order of save as many men as you can in one of the most devastating winter storms on record. Then came Boston Strong, which is about ordinary people thrust into extraordinary circumstances, people that when bombs go off in a crowded street, they don't run away from the smoke and the fire and the debris. They actually run toward it. Again, with that simple human natural instinct to save lives. And now we have a story of a young man at war with his own body, fighting a opponent that he can't see, that takes a little bit away from him every single day.
Mm-hmm.
But this is ultimately a story about love. It's a story about Pete and his wife, Julie, who at 23 years old could have walked away. She was a senior at BC when he was diagnosed with that disease. They had only been dating for 8 months at the time. And I remember when I was first asked to meet the family, and this was right when my movie The Finest Hours was coming out. And you think I don't have time now. I didn't have any time at that point with all the different things that I had to do to promote the movie. And I told this mutual friend of ours, I said, you know, I paid $100 to ALS. I dumped the cold ice water on my head. My kids did the same. You know, it's a blessing what he's done. But I don't have time to meet this young man. And this mutual friend of ours said, Casey, you should meet him. Drive up to Beverly on a Sunday. Now, we live on the South Shore. Driving to Beverly is like driving to Texas.
Yep. It is. He's right.
On a Sunday. And he said, you know what? You are going to find one or two things. You're either going to meet an incredible family or you're going to find your next project. Well, normally I can go into a room and within 5 minutes I'll know whether or not I can write a story or a book based on the subjects that I'm talking to. Within 2 minutes I knew. When I saw Pete, when I saw his wife Julie, when I met his incredible family, I thought, okay, this is a story that needs to be told because of its universality, rather. You know, in a era, in a time where we really spend most of our time, or at least the media does, at tearing people apart, the government tears people down every day. This was one moment in time in 2014 where people in 150 countries around the world got together, again, for one simple reason, which was to save lives. And that was all inspired by a young man who can't talk, a young man who can barely blink his eyes, a young man who can only communicate via his heart and his brain, and that's what he does.
This is the second book that you've gotten together with Dave Wedge, because originally writing the Boston Strong book with him. What was the process like writing with Dave Wedge, who a journalist, you know, a great guy who, you know, you guys got together and You guys are doing big things.
Yeah, you know, we also just formed our first production company together called WIDA Productions, and we've got offices in Los Angeles and in Boston. And the premise there is to take our material, our books, etc., and develop them into feature films or television projects. Not only the things that we write, but stories that other people have written that we believe strongly that should, you know, have another life on the big screen or at least in television. Writing with somebody is almost like writing a song with somebody. You know, Lennon and McCartney, when they would be interviewed about how they worked together, and one would focus on lyrics, the other one would focus on harmony, etc. You know, Dave and I complement each other's skill sets very well. This is Dave's second book. This is my 10th. So, you know, I've already gone through that process of learning how to be a writer. And divorcing myself a little bit from my journalistic background, which is where Dave came from as well, and really focusing on the story itself. As someone once told Ernest Hemingway, who started his career as a reporter for the Toronto Star, Gertrude Stein, who was a mentor of Hemingway's, said, once you start not worrying about the facts, then you're going to find out what the real story is. Mm. Don't be so focused about on the who, what, where, when, and how, and why, but get underneath the surface of the story, and then the truth will ultimately reveal itself. And that's what I do as a writer.
I think it's worth asking with the folks who are here, those who are listening, those folks who may not know you. I know you're known worldwide, but I got to throw it out there to ask, what made you go from being a journalist, a TV producer, to steering into the writing direction?
Well, you know, Kevin, I call myself the accidental author. I never believed I was going to write books one day, but that is until I was thrust into the spotlight because of my work on one case, one of the biggest criminal cases in the history of American crime, the case of the Boston Strangler. Now, for me, this was a personal crusade because my aunt, 19-year-old Mary Sullivan, was the youngest and final victim in that notorious 1960s murder spree. And growing up in an Irish Catholic household on Cape Cod, my aunt's murder was never talked about until I was a teenager and I had seen the film The Boston Strangler on television starring Tony Curtis and Henry Fonda. I thought I knew the story. Or at least I thought I did, and I broached the subject to my mother for the first time. My mother was 17 when her sister was murdered brutally. And I said, Mom, tell me about Mary. And she said, Casey, you know, Mary just wasn't my sister. Mary was my best friend. And my mother was going to, you know, live her life along parallel lines with her older sister. My aunt was 19, my mother was 17. So they were going to raise their families together, grow old together as sisters, and all that was stolen from my mother. And I could tell that the facade that she had put up over the years to really protect my brother and I from the truth was starting to break, and she was starting to get emotional for the first time. And as any son or daughter would, I tried to comfort her, and I said, Mom, well, at least they got the guy. And she said, Casey, I don't know if that's true because no one was ever charged with any of the Boston Strangler murders in the 1960s. It was, you know, the case was left very, you know, had a lot of loose ends to it. So that became my mission in life. I went to journalism school at Boston University because I wanted to find some closure for my mother. Ended up spending 10 years reinvestigating that case, exposing a lot of new truths that hadn't been revealed before. And while I was doing it, some very high-profile writers would come up to me, Sebastian Younger, for example, who had just written The Perfect Storm, and they said, geez, Casey, you know, I saw you on the Today Show or some show that I was on to kind of promote the cause. And they said, your story's fascinating, and we want to write it. And you hear that, and you feel very flattered at first. And then I had to process that, and I said, wait a minute. You know, I'm a journalist. I'm living this. If anybody's going to write it, it has to be me.
Right.
And it's either going to succeed or fail on those merits. And that first book was A Rose for Mary, The Hunt for the Real Boston Strangler. It's really a memoir. Women especially are drawn to it because it's a story about sisters. I'm not the hero of that story. My mother is. My mother is the hero because she had a bond with her sister that lasted 40 years after my aunt was killed. And that bond led me to really where I am today.
we go back to talking a little bit about the Pete Frady story, I believe the governor this week, is this not Pete Frady's week?
Yes. Well, the first week in August.
In August.
Will be, you know, from today on forward, Pete Frady's week in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, which is an incredible thing because, again, in August 2014, Pete Frady's led a social media revolution that raised $220 million for ALS research, which was astronomical. It's still to this day the greatest social media charity campaign in history. And before Pete Frady's came along and before the Ice Bucket Challenge was introduced, annual fundraising for ALS was about $2 to $3 million per year.
It wasn't much.
It wasn't much, which, you know, with a disease like this, because it is a niche disease, it's not lung cancer, but it is a disease that literally destroys entire families. Mm-hmm. And there's no idea of what causes it, which is why so much money was needed to do that groundbreaking research. And what is so valuable about the story of Pete and his family is the fact that that money is now being used to do that research. A year ago, scientists at UMass Medical Center in Worcester, they discovered a gene that they believe will unlock what causes ALS. And if you can find what causes ALS, then you can find a therapy to treat it.
Right.
Eventually, the hope is to obviously cure ALS, but in the meantime, they hope that ALS will be treated as a disease like Parkinson's disease, a manageable disease that allows you to live at least a semi-functional life.
Mm-hmm. September is going to be a busy month for you and Dave. We know that the book is going to be released. Is it going to be released?
Released September 5th, but it's already available for pre-order on Amazon. So if you go on to Amazon.com today, you type in the Ice Bucket Challenge, or you type in my name, Casey Sherman, you can pre-order the book. And pre-orders have been already through the roof. It's already been number one on Amazon for the past month. And that's a testament to that family and to the network they have. And as I said, ultimately, it's a love story. I'll give you just one little snippet, which really drew me into the story, talking to his wife, Julie, this beautiful young woman. They now have a little daughter named Lucy, who's just a miracle child in many ways. And Pete, when he was diagnosed, he already knew what he had. He had an injury to his wrist, and he was self-diagnosing, going on to WebMD, typing in his symptoms, because eventually he was having a hard time buttoning his shirts and putting on his shoes. So every time he put in those symptoms to a search engine, those three letters came back, ALS, ALS. Eventually the doctors caught up to his own diagnosis and told him what he had. His family, mother and dad, were absolutely devastated. He had to go and tell his girlfriend, Julie, who, again, he'd only been dating for 8 months what he had. And during that car ride over to Boston College, he's thinking in his head, well, what's she going to do? Is she going to leave? Of course she is. She's 23 years old, a senior at Boston College. You know, this is my sentence. This is my curse. This isn't hers. So when he gets to the dormitory, she sees him, and she won't get into his car until he tells her what he has. Finally, he does. She looks at him and she says, take me home. And he says, okay, I get it. You know, this is too much for you. And she said, no, Pete, you don't get it. Take me home because I'm moving all of my stuff out of my parents' house and I'm moving in with you.
Wow.
You're my life now. This isn't you. This is us. Now, that's an amazing story of true love and commitment, and I was drawn in immediately right there. I said, okay, this is the story that nobody knows about this family and about this couple, and they will.
Tammy?
I just had a question, and it kind of relates back to when you were speaking about if you wrote a story, you wanted it to be your story. I believe, just based on Facebook, that you're really involved in the movies when they're made. Like,
sure.
Is it the same thing? Like, you have someone else writing a script for your book?
Yeah, you know, your involvement with the productions is that can be, you can be heavily involved in it, or you can not be involved at all. I know writers that have sold their material to movie studios and then take the money they run. They don't even see the films half the time. You know, I feel like I have a responsibility once it gets to that next level to make sure that the story is about as accurate as it can be and to vet the script for any, you know, gross inaccuracies that I can. And fortunately, I've been very tied in to the productions. But, you know, you still need, you want more control over your stories, which is why we started our own production company. And now we've got several different productions or stories in development, including the Ice Bucket Challenge that we're hoping to turn into a feature film. And we hope to shoot it here in New England or in Massachusetts within the next year.
What's that like having, you know, Widow Productions? And probably the question I got to ask you is it strictly just going to be producing movies or TV shows, or might you be the next Netflix?
Oh, jeez.
I'm sorry.
I haven't thought of that, Kevin, but now, you know, that's a great idea.
The streaming services is the way to go.
You know, I mean, it's all about opportunity, and it's all about finding a platform to tell a really compelling story, whether it's here on the radio or whether it's, you know, on a movie screen 40 feet high.
Sure.
If you can connect to an audience, that is the most magical thing in the world. When The Finest Hours came out, I had it was a roller coaster ride.
Now on Netflix.
Now on Netflix. So if you haven't seen it, I hope you do, because it's a really heartwarming, inspiring story. And those are the stories that I ultimately look for. I remember, and just in terms of my own journey, after writing the book, I thought for sure it would be a layup for Hollywood. Hollywood would come knocking on my door and make the film. Hollywood didn't. I had to go out to Hollywood on two occasions, pitch my story in the book to movie studios, and I was turned down every time. They said, Casey, you know, the story's incredible, but here are three reasons why it's never going to get made. One, it's a period piece. When did this take place? Oh, rescue in 1952? Well, unless that ship is called Titanic, no one's ever going to care about this. Two, it takes place on the ocean, which is incredibly costly for any studio. And three, we're Hollywood. We only make movies about superheroes. And that was, at that point, that was my counterargument to them, because I said, you're right. This is a movie about superheroes. They don't wear capes. They don't wear tights. They wear hand-me-down foul weather gear from World War II. And given a little bit of training, they can do something very extraordinary. And after being turned down after, you know, time and time again, I never gave up hope that we would make this film. And I remember walking through Times Square on business one day. And in Times Square, you've got the 40-foot billboards promoting every movie that's coming out at the time. And I sat in the middle of Times Square, and I looked up at one particular billboard, and I told myself, Finest Hours is going to be here someday. I don't know how I'm going to do it, but it's going to happen. So for the next 2 years, I had two copies of my book on me at all times, whether I was getting Dunkin' Donuts coffee or Mary Lou's or gassing up my car at the gas station. I had two copies of my book because I knew I'd meet somebody that would help me along this journey. Turns out I did.
Wow.
And fast forward to 2015, a month before the film comes out, I went down to New York with my children, and there it was in exactly the place I pictured it. A 40-foot billboard for The Finest Hours, and I wept. That was the time where it really became emotional for me, because it was about the journey, not only my journey, but the journey of the men that I wrote about, because I was very close to those heroes before they had passed on. So I felt like it was my responsibility to them to get this film made. Now, can you imagine, it's a week before New Year's Eve, and every security camera is focused on Times Square, and here's a grown man weeping in the middle of Times Square. I'm sure, New York police probably had some questions about me and about what I was doing there. But as I said, it was about the journey for me, and to be able to share that film with people in 80 countries around the world. The book just came out last week in Russia, and it's now number one in the former Soviet Union, which is bizarre to me, but take that, Putin.
I was going to say, do you think Putin bought a copy?
I think, you know, the story of heroism is universal.
We got Gretchen at the end. Gretchen, did you have any questions at all?
You know, I was just thinking, if I were an actress or an actor, I would be waiting to see what was coming from you next. Do you have people calling you saying...
Sure.
You know,
agents calling you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. agents, actors, and you understand, you know, the need for them to be engaging and aggressive. They want a role, so they're going to go after it. Much like I went after getting that movie made. So you respect that. You don't, you know, you can't respond to everybody's inquiry. But, you know, you work with people that you really like. I had the great fortune of working with Casey Affleck on The Finest Hours, who I think was just transformative in that film. And he was also making Manchester by the Sea at the same time.
Academy Award winner.
Yeah, so imagine shooting for 2 weeks in on the North Shore, coming down to the South Shore to do The Finest Hours and changing your entire personality to fit that role. I thought it was brilliant. I think he's, you know, the best actor we have going right now. We've got a great relationship, and, you know, I hope that we're going to be working together on a project very soon.
Yeah, we are speaking with Casey Sherman, award-winning journalist and best-selling author. I think we want to, I want to kind of just digress back to the Ice Bucket Challenge. Big book launch celebration, Fenway Park. Folks who want to get a signed copy, just so you know, locally, Falmouth Museum on the Green. 7 p.m.
Sure.
A discussion and signing.
Yep. And we're going to be doing also signing in Hingham. I think that's October.
We're going to have a lot. Yeah, October 7th.
Thank you, Kevin. but we're going to be, a full book tour beginning September 5th. The day that the book is launched, we're going to have a Pete Frates Day celebration at City Hall Plaza in Boston, really celebrating the goodness of the human spirit. You know, after so much negativity, like I said, that we are talking about, that we're, you know, force-fed every single day, it's always a great moment to celebrate positivity. And this is certainly a story like that. And I think we have to remember that there are more stories like that than there are the negative stories. We just have to find them and really cultivate them and share them with the world. So we're extremely proud of that. Now, Pete Frates has gone through hell and back this summer. His death
was a rumor,
misreported by Mike Barnacle.
Is that when you know you've made it, though?
What's that?
Is that how you know you've made it?
The day that it happened, I had been very, in close contact with his family when he'd been back to the hospital, and the morning it happened. And again, Pete was, he was hanging by a thread physically for quite a while.
Wow.
And so when I got on the Facebook that morning and saw Pete Frates RIP, my heart just sank.
Yeah.
And the first thing I did is I called his mother, Nancy, left a message. I just said, I'm here. Whenever you want to reach out, I'm here. Within 2 seconds, she called me back. I was shocked because I didn't think I'd hear from her. And she said, Casey, I'm just coming back from the church, and I hear that Pete's passed away on the radio. He's not dead. We just left him at the hospital. We've talked to his caregiver. He is alive. Can you get on social media and refute the story? Which is what we did. And after the craziness calmed down, I told the family. I said, well, this is a blessing in disguise, because for one thing, it triggered another round of donations to ALS research. And if you want to get Pete better, piss him off. And that's what Mike Barnacle did. Pete's a natural competitor.
Sure.
Pete was a college athlete. And Pete, once he heard that, his competitive spirit kicked in, as it always has in moments where he's been in dire stress, and he got better. And he's home today, and actually his wife tweeted out a picture of Pete wearing a T-shirt with our book cover on it, which
awesome.
Is amazing.
That's awesome.
50% of the proceeds for the book all go to Pete. This is a charitable effort for myself and my co-author. We were on a mission to write this book, because we had to do it. We had to share it, and we had to make sure that Pete, has all the available medical equipment and care that he needs, because he is this beacon of hope, I think, for the entire world. And, he fully believes that he's going to get up one day and he's going to walk his daughter Lucy on the playing fields of his youth. And, people have counted out Pete so many times, and he's proven them all wrong. So I would never count out Pete Frates.
I have to say, I love having you on the program on a regular basis, and we thank you. And I thank you for being a part of this program here live at the Kingston Council on Aging. We just got a couple of moments left, but could we tease folks about a couple of other things that you kind of, the irons that you have in the fire? We know that you and Dave were up working on yet another project. You were up at Gillette Stadium, kind of peeking in on Tom Brady, and another gentleman that you worked with, Mike Tugas.
Mike Tugas, yeah, who I wrote The Finest Hours with. We have a follow-up book called Above and Beyond, which is going to come out next winter, and that's a book about the U2 Cuban Missile Crisis back in 1962. And it's a similar story in The Finest Hours in that it's a story about, you know, ordinary men with training, the pilots who are actually flying the sorties over Cuba during those intense 13 days when the U.S. and Soviet Union came closest to nuclear holocaust.
Who will blink?
Oh, exactly.
Who will blink?
And to be able to research that story and talk to many of the people who lived it. My father was a Marine in 1962. He was part of the first invasion force stationed in Miami. If we were going to invade Cuba, he was going to be one of the first boots on the ground.
Wow.
And it would have been the biggest invasion since D-Day. Fortunately, we had a president in the Oval Office at the time who gave pause and who thought more than acting first. He thought first before he did that. So it's really a really powerful, strong story, and I think it really teaches us the meaning of leadership and courage and grace under fire. And you mentioned why we were at Gillette Stadium. Well, we're...
And this is because you're a Patriots fan and you like a training camp, is it?
I know. I'm a Patriots fan, but we're doing a book on the incredible 2016-17 season that began with Deflategate and ended with the greatest comeback Super Bowl win in history. And we've been spending a lot of time with Tom Brady's legal team in Washington, D.C., the men and women who defended him in a court of law, and their story is fascinating. This story is, it's not necessarily a sports story. It's more akin to Spotlight, which was the great film that exposed the the corruption in the Catholic Church. You know, this is a story that exposes the corruption in the NFL, the corruption in corporate America. If they can tear down the biggest name in their industry for one, you know, word and one word only, which is power, they can do that to anybody.
Mm.
And that's the story that we're going to tell.
Can't wait. If folks want to follow you, find out some of the stuff that you're working on, do you have a website? Do you have a way for folks?
My address is now. I would say, you know, the easiest way to get in touch with me is strictly on Facebook.
Yep.
You know, Casey Sherman on Facebook, because I don't have a website because you can't really engage with your readers that way. And I, as you know, I'm very approachable.
You are.
And I always love to hear from folks who have read my book. Sometimes they like it. Sometimes they don't.
You want to hear both.
You want to hear both, you know. As long as it's constructive and not a personal attack, I'm always willing to certainly engage because it's my job as a writer to continue to try to get better.
Well, we want to thank you very much for joining us. We look forward to talking to you again. Good luck on the book launch.
Thank you very much. September 5th,
yep.
Ice Bucket Challenge comes out nationwide. Pre-order it today on Amazon because they will be running out within probably 24 hours of the book launch because so many people are ordering it.
Yep.
But it's a love story. It's a story that, you know, everybody can read. And your children, I think, will be really fascinated by the story as well.
And not that I'm here to plug anything else for you, but you know what? Check out some of his other books, too.
Thank you.
Can find them on Amazon. They're right there.
They're right
there.
It's that
easy.
I appreciate it.
Casey, thank you. Folks, round of applause for Casey Sherman here. All right, we're going to step aside, and when we come back, more Monday Night Talk.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
Ever see a windshield crack grow smaller? Not ever. I'm Peter Brown of Tiny & Sons Glass in Pembroke. Windshield cracks grow like a bad toothache. The reason is, you come out of your warm house into cold air. You reach for that cold door handle. Your windshield is cold. You turn on a defroster. Your windshield is hot. Windshield expands. Not much, just enough to pull that crack along. Advice, check your windshield now. Little dings, starburst, bullseyes. We'll fix them before they grow awful. Just call 1-888-64-TINIES. And thank you.
McGuigan's Pub in downtown Whitman is a great place to unwind any night of the week. Stop in for Singo on Monday night. There's the always popular Irish Sessions every Tuesday night, half-price pizza every Wednesday night, and Friday and Saturday nights feature the best in live entertainment. Catch your favorite game on McGuigan's 8 big flat screens and enjoy a pint at their beautiful 54-foot mahogany bar. Whether you're a regular or coming in for the first time, you're always a friend of McGuigan's Pub, 546 Washington Street, Whitman Center.
Monday Night Talk continues all week long. Go to 95.9WATD.com/Monday Night Talk and keep in touch on Facebook and Twitter. And now, more Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi. Download previous episodes of Monday Night Talk and listen to them anywhere. Check out 959WATD.com/Monday Night Talk. And now, more Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talk for our final segment, probably the best segment of the evening. Joining us is number one New York Times bestselling author Dean Koontz, and he's here to discuss his new suspense novel, The Silent Corner, which is the first in a new series, which is already optioned for television. Welcome to Monday Night Talk, Mr. Koontz.
Thanks for having me there.
So I want to ask you, you're known as probably one of the most widely read authors. You have over 500 million copies sold in 38 languages. At one point in your life, did you know that you wanted to be a writer?
Strangely enough, it goes back to when I was at least to when I was 8 years old. And when I was 8 years old, I started writing stories on tablet paper and drawing the cover and stapling the left edge and covering the staples with tape so nobody would prick their fingers, and then tried to sell those to relatives for a nickel. So it began very early with me. I was the writer, the publisher, the agent, the bookseller, all of that in one. And I've never been 100% sure where that came from, because there were no books in our house.
Okay. Well, we recently, you know, we like having authors on from time to time, and Hank Phillippe Ryan, who is actually an investigative reporter for a local Boston area television station, now has found her groove as a mystery writer. I got to ask you, what was your career early on until you achieved enough success just to be a full-time writer?
Well, I sold my first short story when I was a senior in college, and it had won a prize in a contest that at that time the Atlantic Monthly sponsored for college student writers, and it was very nice to get the certificate and the praise from the English department, but there was not a dollar associated with the prize, and I took the same story and sold it in those days for $50, which was much more than the now, when paperbacks back then cost 50 cents.
Right.
I thought, wow, here I get 100 paperbacks. That was not going to be enough to keep me alive, but I started selling science fiction short stories and novels, mostly paperbacks. And because I had read those as almost my exclusive genre as a child, but by the time I got to be, I think I was about 25 or something like that, I realized that this isn't what I wanted to be writing for the future. So I gave that up, and my wife made me this offer. She said, I know you want to write. You're proving you can do it, and I think you can make a living at it. And let's see. She said, I'll support you for 5 years, and if you can't make it in 5 years, you can never make it. And I tried to negotiate up to 7, but she has Sicilian blood, so she always wins those kind of negotiations. And about 5 years later, she was able to quit her job and go to work here running things like the whole financial side of everything. So it took quite a while. People think you've been a bestseller for a long time, that it was overnight, but it was not by no means overnight.
Okay. It's rumored that you read approximately 200 books a year, and you probably have a little over 40,000 books in your library. What types of books catch your interest?
Well, that's probably a little thing you've read from early on. The first I think the first couple of decades we were married, we each read about 200 books a year. Most of them were fiction at that time, but that had a lot to do with how I learned to write fiction, was reading so much of it in so many different genres. But now I read a great deal for research, especially on this new series, these Jane Hawk books, starting with The Silent Corner. There's a huge amount of stuff I needed to research in every level. And it's funny, because when I was a kid in high school and college, I hated going to the library, doing research, and I always faked it. I made fake resources and put footnotes to books and authors who didn't even exist. It's something I'm not terribly proud of, but and years passed where nobody ever caught me at it. And now I find, as an adult and working, writing fiction, that the research is one of the things I love the most. So finally, I'm maturing.
See, today you're known, the world knows you as a marvelous storyteller. But there was a time that you actually delved into science fiction novels like Star Quest and Demon Seed, which you wrote in 73 and then rewrote in 1997. Is the creative process any different than writing suspense novels?
I'd say it's different in writing every kind of novel. When I gave up the science fiction, I bought back the rights to all books except Demon Seed. I couldn't get that back, and put them out of print forever so there'd be no confusion. And then I was writing suspense. I moved from that into writing things with somewhat of a supernatural bent, also started introducing comedy to them. And now it's sort of, right now with this series, I'm sort of flat out grab you by the throat suspense, but also is about some serious issues. And I've found over the years that as I've changed the kind of thing I write, each one requires something different of you, but in a way, nothing less. It's why I often say literary fiction is simply a different genre from mysteries or from science fiction or from suspense. They all require something considerable from you as a writer if you're going to do it well.
Okay. We're speaking with the number one New York Times bestselling author, Dean Koontz. He's here to discuss his new suspense novel, The Silent Corner. Now, in the newest book, which hit the stores on June 20th, we meet Jane Hawk, FBI agent gone rogue. If you will, share with our listeners a little background on this fascinating character.
Well, I sat down. Sometimes you know where a book, what the seed for it was, and sometimes you don't. And in this case, I didn't. I knew I wanted to write a story featuring a female FBI agent on leave or maybe gone rogue. By the end of book one, she's totally rogue. But I didn't know what it was going to be about or what it was that impelled her into this. And I thought I would write it in little moments, like smaller scenes, so that instead of introducing a character, telling you about the character, and setting up the storyline or the central conflict, that I would just follow her through a series of small scenes, letting her reveal a little bit about herself here and a little bit about herself there, and also raise more questions about her as you learn things. And I'd never got a story going that way before, and by the time I was probably, I'd say 20 pages into it, I knew I had a very uninteresting character here. And the way it evolved as those early chapters got going was I realized Jane was on the road alone. She on the road alone because her husband, a career Marine at the age of 32 and a full colonel, the youngest in the Marine Corps, killed himself, and she has never believed he killed himself. And she's looking into his suicide and discovers there are all these suicide rate has escalated in the U.S., and there's about 8,000 additional suicides a year than usual, and these are almost exclusively among people who are successful in their fields, happily married or happy in their other circumstances, and never been depressed. And that fits the profile of her husband. So she, at that point, very much wants to know what's going on here. And that's when she and, give a tiny plot point away in the first one, she and her five-year-old son come under threat. And Jane has to hide out her child, and and try to understand what's going on, and pretty soon becomes the most wanted fugitive in America. The character just, I laugh, I say sometimes I've been married 50 years, and this is the second time I've fallen in love with a woman, but this one's fictional, so it's not going to lead to divorce. And Jane is just the most fascinating character I've ever gotten. I'm working on book four with her, and it's the combination of her toughness. She's as tough as it gets, but also has this enormous good heart and a tender side. And all of this together, I don't know how long I can write about Jane and be fascinated, but so far, book by book, I'm more fascinated each time I go back to her.
And you actually, one of my questions was, is it true that you're, you know, that Jane has become one of your favorite characters to write about? Why is that, that she is so fascinating, and what makes her different than any other of the other characters that you have written about in the past?
Well, I've written many women character leads, but in this one, I tend to let characters describe who they are. I don't sit down with character notes. I don't start with a plot outline. And if a character comes on a scene, I know, in this case, I knew it wanted to be this woman FBI agent. I knew almost immediately she was widowed. But I let her tell me who she is. And if I can, what fascinates me is all kind of elements about her. But I know one of the things that fascinates other people, because so many in my publishing life, from my editor to my publishers here and elsewhere, they come back to her wit, and I don't mean by that necessarily her humor, although she has a very dry wit, but they mean that she is, one of them said to me, how, she is so intelligent, she figures these things out, and how did you get that? They said, well, Jane can figure something out in 1 minute to do, and you go, wow, that was cool. But I sit here for 4 days trying to figure out what that'll be. I'm unfortunately not as intelligent as Jane, but it's her intelligence, her cleverness that partly drives this. And then I've gotten a lot of feedback. My editor said, I just love the way she talks to the bad guys. Mm. And I will say, I've never seen another character, I've certainly never written one, who talks to people in the way that Jane does. And there's just something about her attitude that is just so enormously appealing. I'm getting a lot of fan mail on the book now that it's been out a week. And there's a thing repeated where people say, I wish she was real. I wish she was a friend of mine. And that's what I think makes her appeal to me. I wish I had friends who were this tough-minded, and yet this sensitive, and underlying it so sweet. And yet, she walks a very fine line. Sometimes you think she's stepping over a line here and doing something I don't approve of. But until you follow her through it, and you realize, no, she never goes too far over the line. And that's another thing in an age when often characters in these roles, the police authority, are portrayed as corrupt. Jane is not corrupt. But when she's dealing with very corrupt people, she knows how to play on their level.
How much research did you have to put in to Jane Hawk in order to, you know, develop that fine line between her, that tough exterior, but yet she has a sensitive side too?
Well, there was an enormous amount of research based on the very fact that once Jane she takes leave of absence, but when she suddenly it's no longer a leave of absence, and she's being hunted by let's call it a conspiracy or a cabal. It's part government, part private industry. And they're trying to hide something of great importance to the future of the world. And she has to go off the grid, and that became a big research issue. And in figuring out how she goes off the grid, how she can use the Internet but not be caught or tracked, how she can use a car because she has to use one with no GPS. She can't use a regular cell phone, and she can't even use a burner phone for any protracted length of time in a metropolitan area because the NSA has a way of tracking even burner phones if they're used two consecutively. it's all these things that I had to learn about. And I found out very quickly that all the people who think they're off the grid aren't off the grid at all. And these preppers we see on TV, they're nowhere near off the grid. And so when Jane had to learn to be almost invisible, and there's always somebody at her heels because there's people just as smart as she is trying to catch her. She's no superwoman. When I had to research all that, it started refining that's all sides of Jane. It had to bring her, she had to be a lot more clever than I probably would have originally written her. And as that cleverness came in, as the intelligence grew in the character, I think it sharpened both her toughness and her tenderness, because I've always felt that if you combine intelligence with common sense, you'll get some of the best people you know. But if you have intelligence with no common sense, there you've got a master criminal.
If I can add a little addendum to the what you just said, this is straight out of your book before part one, Rock Me. Those who are truly off the grid and cannot be tracked by any technology, yet are able to move about freely and use the internet, are said to be in the silent corner. It's straight out of your book, which is well said. That kind of captured me just thumbing through the first few pages. I go, ooh, some intrigue here. And there's some thrilling turns in the book. And, of course, you have to build in kind of a cliffhanger to hook folks for the next book, which is due out early next year. What was that like to try to keep folks captivated throughout the book with different twists and turns, and then also, you know, have them stay on board for your next book coming out in January?
Well, it's one thing I try to do when I'm there's two kinds of series. There's this kind of series in which you meet a character, and the character is always the same book by book, always simply on another case. Or in this case, for what I believe will be seven books. I don't think that's the only ones I'll write about Jane, but the first seven books will have an overriding arc. But nevertheless, each one has to stand alone. She has to achieve things at the end of the book, and even though she hasn't reached perfect safety, you have had quite a ride with her, and then that's a fair kind of series book to do in this vein. But I didn't consciously do any cliffhanger. What I felt about these was that if you love these books, you're going to love them largely because of the character. Now, they really move, I think. I wanted to make these books just speed along, and I wanted to have lots of twists and turns in them, which sort of eventuates pretty naturally from the setup. But when I got to the end, I want you to be able to have, of each volume, take a very deep breath and feel, man, she made it. But yet, there's more that's coming. And so that's sort of how I left the first one. She's achieved a lot of what you would wanted to see done. But this conspiracy is much more, it's like a hydra. And if you cut off one head, that doesn't mean there isn't another one. And so far, I'm working on book four, and I'm involved in it with the same level of excitement as the first one. So I hope that'll convey to readers. I certainly try my hardest at it.
Yeah, my understanding is that Jane has kind of helped renew you as a writer. Is that accurate?
I would say that's true, yeah. When you've been at it as long as I have, you've tried your hand at a lot of different things, publishers generally don't like that. They like you to do one book of the same kind over and over. And I've moved around to different kind of things. So I've had my chance at trying almost anything that interested me or I felt was challenging. And when it came to this, you thought, okay, I want to do something with this, a character like this, and do something I haven't seen done before. But still in all, I've written suspense before. So when you're writing it and suddenly you know you've got your hands on something electrifyingly different and something that just excites you, it's a wonderful thing, and it's happened to me before when I've been writing, and that makes it, especially if it happens in the first 20 or 30 pages of the manuscript and you've got 350 more to go and you're excited off the top of the charts, that is a blessing, because the book is going to be hard work. They always are hard work, but it's not going to be that kind of hard work it makes you smash your forehead into the desktop several times a day in frustration. It's going to be hard work that bears fruit every day. And so in that sense, she really has enlivened me and brought me back to the excitement you have when you're doing the early books in your career.
You are listening to Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD, heard worldwide, 95.9WATD.com. And we're privileged to be speaking with the best-selling author, Dean Koontz, about his newest book, The Silent Corner. Dean, how soon could we see Jane, either on network television or cable? Because from, again, what I'm understanding here is this is an option for television.
Yeah, it's been optioned by Paramount TV. They actually optioned all the Jane books that there might be, and in association with Anonymous Content. And Anonymous Content has, I think, 5 shows on there recently or still on the air, and they do very classy, stylish stuff, and they seem very excited about it. So, but all of this is a slow process, so these days it does happen a little faster if they get the right showrunner on it. And so I'm very hopeful, but I haven't always had good luck with Hollywood, given how TV is these days, that it's the place where you see most of what you want to see as compared to feature-length films, which have gotten kind of redundant one after the other, mm-hmm. the same kind of thing. TV is allowing more flexibility in storylines and more cutting-edge kind of stuff. So I'm very hopeful about it, but I've been around the track before, so I don't go to bed hooting with joy that there's going to be a TV series. But I think it's more likely than not going to be good.
Okay. I would ask you, and I would pull this from your frequently asked questions, do you have any movies that are based on your novels, or do you have any that could be in the works?
There's another TV series that seems to be moving forward. It's not filming or anything, but that's based on the novel Ashley Bell that was out about 2 years ago, and a series of novellas I wrote interconnected with the world of the novel. And that was all optioned by Universal, and I know they've been working on that. And there's a couple of things bouncing around in the feature film area, but again, I don't... I always advise young writers when they get... it's so exciting. I got my new book done, and now I'm taking a break from books because I'm writing a screenplay based on it. I always wish them great good luck, but warn them, you can write a script that everybody loves that gets greenlighted, and then after it's greenlighted, which used to mean it would almost certainly be filmed, then you will get some young, very enthusiastic, but megalomaniacal director that will be assigned to it, who will some way or other ruin the entire project before it ever gets a chance to go before the camera. And so far, when I've given that warning, there's nobody that hasn't come back and said a couple of years later, boy, I wish I'd have understood what you were telling.
Right.
So I will not be writing any more feature films or TV. I wrote and sold a number of them, but I'm not a guy that can work in a collaborative medium, I guess you would say, and that is all very collaborative. I like to have the total control, and unless you're Steven Spielberg, you don't have total control, and it's too frustrating a medium.
Well, we just got a couple of more moments with you, Dean, and I want to kind of stay on the TV thing, because I'm not sure if this is accurate or not, but I believe that you're a fan of the reality show, the TV show Survivor. Is that true?
No, in fact, I've never watched it.
Okay. I thought it was something that I had seen on your website, that you were a fan of a series like that.
I'm trying to think what that might have been. What I watch with television is usually series, and I usually binge watch. I wait until it's been on, like Breaking Bad was completely finished before my wife and I started to watch it, mm-hmm. and became so hooked that one Saturday we watched 10 episodes in a row. And that I liked, and the series that sprang out of that, Better Call Saul, I think, is
yep.
one of the finest things on television. So I tend to not watch much TV, and I don't watch a whole lot of of reality TV. In fact, I'm not sure I watch any. So that might be something on the website we have to go clear up.
Okay. And probably the final thing I would ask you is tell folks as far as if they want to find out more about things that you're working on, whether it's your website, whether it's your publisher's work website, or maybe social media, how can they follow what Dean Koontz is up to?
Well, we one way is the website, which is deankoontz.com, and it's a pretty well-maintained website. It's a lot of content on it, and we put up news as there is any news to put up. And I think my publisher takes care of the Facebook. We have about 1.3 million friends on there, and if we ever get together for a picnic, we're going to need a year to get ready for it and make all that potato salad.
Well, we want to thank you for coming on, and we know that this is airing prior to your birthday, so we want to wish you an early birthday. Your birthday is coming up on the 9th, correct?
July 9th.
July 9th.
And, I stopped counting them some time ago, but I'm very happy to keep having them.
Well, we wish you a very happy birthday, and we thank you very much for coming in and appearing on Monday Night Talk and talking about the book and when the Whisper Room is ready for release. We would love to have you back on to tease folks more about Jane Hawk and what she's up to.
I would be very happy to be there. It's been you draw out your guests very well, so that is a blessing for somebody on this end of the phone.
Well, listen, you have yourself a fantastic day and evening, and we look forward to hopefully talking to you more down the road.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Our guest has been the one and only Dean Koontz. Again, a gentleman who has sold, that's a fantastic number, 500 million copies in nearly 40 languages worldwide. A gentleman who has 14 novels that have risen to number one on the New York Times hardcover best-selling list. Titles including One Door Away from Heaven, Dragon Tears, The Husband, Odd Hours, What the Night Knows, just some great books. And again, he was here to chat with us a little bit about this new book, which is a fantastic book. If you haven't, if you're somebody who loves suspense novels, you definitely want to check this one out. And again, we thank Dean, and we thank his publisher, Penguin Random House, for that fantastic interview. Having a chance to speak with a gentleman who, you know, you heard the story as to how he got started. I wanted to make sure I built that in instead of just talking about the book. Had a chance to kind of get a little insight into how he got started in writing books and the deal he cut with Gerda, his wife, who he pays tribute to in the first handful of pages in the book, which is pretty cool. Well, that's going to do it for us here. Have yourself a great night.
South Shore's breaking news, weather, and traffic station.
95.9 WATD-FM Marshfield and 95.9 WATD.com.